It can go so good in the blink of an eye. That lottery ticket comes up big. That gal you had your eye on for so long unexpectedly says yes when you ask her out. The college you dreamed of sends you that bulky acceptance letter. After years of trying, the pregnancy test strip comes up the right color. It can all go bad in a blink of an eye. A friend told me of a trip to see a friend and their daughter, which she took. And as she was driving on the highway, she noticed that the load on the trailer right ahead of her seemed a bit precarious. And as she prepared to back off, a railroad tie shot out of the back of the trailer and landed right in front of her Jeep. She still has no idea how she failed to roll over as she successfully swerved to avoid the timber. And then she arrived at her friend's home to find them all in tears. The best friend of the family's daughter, just 8, had just been diagnosed with leukemia, and they were facing 2 years of chemotherapy. Now this farmer, we are told at the outset of our parable, this farmer is wealthy. He should not have a care in the world. He should enjoy life in all its rich potential. And yet for him, it's just the opposite. He's presented with an opportunity, a terrific crop. And yet he can only see this as a problem of how he can store it away. In a tight-knit agrarian society, where the problem of one is the problem of all, there are many at hand who in the normal course of things would be quick to offer their counsel and to share their thoughts about what to do. But the greedy farmer acts alone in isolation. The only conversations he has are with himself. The solution he arrives at can be described in just 4 short words. It's all about me. I'll tear down my barns. I'll build bigger ones. I'll gather in my grains and my goods, and I'll say to myself, self, you've done well. Think for a minute how it could have been different. He could have rejoiced with his neighbors in that bumper crop bestowed on him by God. He could have welcomed them into a conversation about what to do with this opportunity. He could have realized that there was a ready place for the storage of this abundance right at hand in the mouths of those who hungered in the community. He was, in fact, a prisoner of his wealth. He was ruled by anxiety over the future, dominated by a greed which sought to control that future through hoarding in the present. And then it gets worse. But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?" Andy Gustafson writes of his visit to Craterock Castle in Victoria, British Columbia, an imposing mansion built in the late 1800s by Robert Dunsmuir, a rags-to-riches coal baron, one of British Columbia's wealthiest citizens. Dunsmuir, the idol of Canadian high society, was notorious for his callous treatment of his workers. He refused all efforts to improve the safety of the mines. He paid the lowest wages in the industry. And when a strike seemed imminent, he locked out his miners and he cut their pay by a third when they returned. And that imposing castle that he built off the backs of his laborers, he died before it was completed. I suspect only a few of you have seen what is probably the best television drama series ever made, AMC's Breaking Bad. Walter White, the protagonist of the series, is a likable good guy. He's a family man with a lovely wife and a teenage son with cerebral palsy. Walt is a high school chemistry teacher who out of the blue is diagnosed with lung cancer, and he's given only a year or two to survive, only a year or two to live. How would you respond to that news? Would it change you? Would you live your life differently? Now, Walter White is a chemist, and when asked about chemistry in one of the early episodes, this is what he says. He says, technically, chemistry is the study of matter, but I prefer to see it as the study of change. And in response to his diagnosis, Walter White does change. He begins a new career. I'm thinking of Bruce's thought about being a bank robber. He decides to be a criminal mastermind, and he cooks up crystal meth. Also, he might lay up a hefty inheritance for his wife and his family. And part of the fascination of the series is watching Walter White continually coming to forks in the road, decision points, where he could decide that he has made enough and he can get out, or instead he can sink to a new level of evil. In theological terms, he is offered the chance for redemption, the opportunity to change for the better and begin anew. But instead he falls deeper and deeper into sin. He has broken bad. A colleague of mine, a terrific pastor here in Massachusetts, just a couple years my senior, was making great strides in turning her church around through what is called a discipleship model of being church, a way of doing church that is less about traditional structures of church membership, pledge drives, boards, and committees, and more about a commitment of those who are gathered within the church to grow in their faith. A great smile, tons of energy, one who joyfully embraces the challenge of passing on the faith in these times when church is a tough sell in many places and for many people. But when on Good Friday she visited her family physician to check out a nagging back pain, she found she had stage 4 cancer. But God said to her, "You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?" The treatments have been relentless. Like anyone facing cancers of this type, it's been a roller coaster ride, physically, emotionally, spiritually. There has been, of course, fear and despair, but also hope and a new appreciation of what we often take for granted. She took a medical leave from her duties as pastors, but in a way, he's expanded her ministries by making regular postings on an online blog called Caring Bridge. She writes regular updates on her treatments of what's going on and what she's learning through all this. And so anyone can go online and read about her joy in no longer having to worry about dieting. Now when she's up to it, she takes delight in eating whatever she pleases. And you can read about her surprise that her hair didn't fall out because of the chemotherapy. And so she went to a stylist and got it dyed pink with purple highlights. And then from a later entry, she wrote, "And now I want a tattoo. I've settled on the design. I want on my left inner forearm, so I can see them, the words, Then we will see face to face, which is from 1 Corinthians chapter 13, her favorite scripture passage. She writes, "These are words I hang on to. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face, the face of God, the face of Jesus, the face of my mother. That's what's awaiting me beyond this life. And it is a comforting promise." Friends, this is the hard and painful and beautiful truth of the matter. We are all in the position of the biblical rich fool, of the Canadian coal baron, of the fictitious Walter White, of the energetic pastor with great plans. This very night, this very year, this very decade, sometime and before we are ready for it. You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? It is, in truth, not a matter of if, but when. And so, to quote Mary Oliver, the poet we just heard Marianne read from, "Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild, precious life? How shall we respond to this graciously given opportunity? Shall we live for ourselves, storing up precious treasure, single-mindedly focusing on building more and more barns for our stuff which we think will save us, because we foolishly tell ourselves it's all about me? Or shall we keep our eye on the true prize and, running the race with perseverance, be rich toward God and thus obtain a heavenly reward, not just down the road when this precious life is over, but here, now, in this life as well? And what it takes for you is a tattoo on the forearm which says, 'Then we shall see face to face,' well, maybe that's the way to go. Or maybe we would do well to remember the lesson of the American tourist who traveled to Poland in the last century to visit the famous rabbi, Hofetz Chaim. Noticing that in his room there was only a table, a chair, a bed, and some books, the American asked, 'Rabbi, where is your furniture?' The rabbi replied, 'My furniture? Where is your furniture, my friend? But I am only a tourist passing through,' said the American. 'So am I,' replied the rabbi. 'So am I.'